Welcome to Warriors for Peace. This weekly broadcast honors the men and women from different countries and cultures who have served and fought in various ways for the peace and rights that freedom brings. There are those also who serve daily to help preserve peace and the rights that come with freedom. I call these individuals Warriors for Peace. This is Donna Sebo, and I will be your host for the next hour. In the 1990s, there was actually a very big shift that occurred in the United States. I think it actually started a little bit before the 1990s, more like the latter part of, or the middle part, actually, I should say, of the 1980s. Now, what am I referring to? I'm referring to the tremendous migration of manufacturing in the United States to overseas facilities. It affected the American economy and the manufacturing industry in a very, very dramatic way. I know here in the Pacific Northwest, it had a very strong impact, and it had an impact on places throughout the United States in ways and manners that were never really anticipated. But we are in a phenomenal shift and change. And for all of the conversations that were made during the years from that time frame, even until now, there has been a sense of discouragement, a sense of, gee whiz, the United States is not what it used to be. Well, we're going to be having a conversation with Rebecca Fannin. Her new book is Silicon Heartland, Transforming the Midwest from the Rust Belt to the Tech Belt. Now, this is important because if you think that the United States and the people therein are not willing to shift and change, you're in for an eye-opening conversation that Rebecca and I are going to have. Rebecca Fannin, I want to welcome you to the show.
Well, thank you very much. I'm very glad to be on your show.
Rebecca, you're a journalist. Now, journalism is really often a subject matter. People say, what is the truth? Now, you've been an investigative reporter in your own way for a long time, and you've written other very, very informative books, especially relating to China. The Silicon Dragon, Startup Asia, and the Tech Titans of China. Those are three. Each of those required a lot of research about a country that rose up out of a very, very difficult cycle, a country that encouraged capitalism, which was not its particular format, to rise to a positioning of prominence that puts it face to face with the United States. When you started doing your experience in traveling to your own hometown in Ohio, it brought something to your attention that was quite significant. What caused you to make a trip to your own hometown, and what encouraged you to put together this book, Silicon Heartland, which is giving a whole new image of the United States and the people in it?
Well, there was a pivotal moment. I was reading the New York Times in New York City. This is a few years ago, and the front page story was about the opioid crisis, and the worst city in the nation for this drug addiction was Portsmouth, Ohio, and that's where a lot of my relatives are from, Portsmouth, Ohio, on the Ohio River, and I just couldn't believe it, and at the same day, actually, I'd been interviewed by the Times, so I was quoted in the Times on another article this very same day. It was just such a weird circumstance. And I went to go out exploring what exactly was happening in the heartland. I couldn't believe that the area that I grew up in, that my parents grew up in, my grandparents, my cousins, all my relatives grew up in this area, this is the worst opioid crisis place in the nation. So I went out exploring, and I put this project on fast forward when COVID hit, because I was not going to China anymore, as I had been doing for a number of years in investigating what was going on in China and other frontier markets in Asia. I wasn't going there anymore, particularly not during COVID. So I went in my Honda Element car and did a very grassroots road trip throughout the heartland and visited many of these cities that are in transition and saw what was going on firsthand. In my hometown region, I saw that this picture of this devastation and this poverty and despair was not as bad as had been portrayed, that there was really a tech innovation happening that I knew and I was familiar about from covering Silicon Valley and being in Silicon Valley for many years and covering what happened in China with the birth of Silicon Dragon. So I could spot these trends, and being a journalist, I interviewed people who are on the front lines of making these changes happen. And that's how the book came about.
This part of, as you describe it, the heartland of the United States, famous people in the last century that made a tremendous difference. You talk about Carnegie, Mellon, Rockefeller. There's just all of these different people. There's so many more that were such contributors to the American industrialization, development of a level of economy that just was phenomenal. And after the Second World War, there were so many industries that just exploded because the whole landscape had changed. Education, flexibility, the infrastructure of travel, all of the different things that came after the Second World War, it made such a huge difference. And we had so much innovation in this country. And then when the 1980s came in and there was that shift into China, there was such discouragement. And everybody in the manufacturing and the industrial environment were just absolutely devastated on so many levels. But here we are today, because of your book and because of some other people that I've become aware of that are saying, don't give up on innovators because we've got them and we hear about them every once in a while. Everybody knows about Steve Jobs and Bill Gates and, you know, just so many other individuals. They're in the news quite frequently. But what we don't hear about and what is kept very quiet are the people that have been in a position to say, we're going to make a difference. And that is what your book is about. And it is making this the change that's evolving. People need to know what's happening because our young people need to understand there are going to be jobs for them. But it's different from what their ancestors were able to prepare for. Yet preparation is the key, is it not?
That's right. Yeah. It's not these factory jobs anymore. Those factory jobs have largely gone overseas. And today we're seeing advanced manufacturing with robotics and also Internet of Things and much more of an automated kind of environment in today's heartland. It's not about working on the assembly line. Those days are going away, and it's becoming much more of a tech-oriented kind of job. And we are seeing some of this reshoring, too, some of these industrial companies coming back in and rebuilding in places that they had left like 20 or 30 years ago and now coming back in again and rebuilding. So it's been interesting, but it's not the old kinds of jobs anymore. It's not blue-collar kind of jobs, factory work. There has to be a lot of retraining today for today's tech jobs.
And that is what I think is so significant. Now, when I was going through your book, one of the things that I found that was very significant, your parents really believe strongly in education. They believe very strongly in education, and they invested in themselves, and that desire for inquiry, for examination, for what do we need to be aware of was very strongly implanted in you. And here you go back into an environment that when you were younger, you wanted to do everything you could to escape from the environment of decline that was happening. And here you are now saying, well, guess what? The world is changing. It's not going to change overnight. But by golly, it is happening. Now, you found in this exploration you did more than 150, and I'll use your word, change makers that just absolutely created a shift with you. What was that like?
Well, it's very inspiring to interview people like that who are making a difference in their community, whether it's regional or local or statewide. People like John Chambers, who this ex-CEO of Cisco, one of the biggest companies, most valuable companies in the world, and he's from West Virginia. So he is going back and giving back to his home state and to the university, West Virginia University in Morgantown, West Virginia, in coal mining area and the chemical manufacturing area that had been depleted because those jobs are going away. So people like that who are giving back, who are leading the charge, who are inspiring others to come along and to actually to try something different, to try entrepreneurship, to try a startup, to try to strike out on their own, to, you know, go out on their own rather than the traditional manufacturing route of the Rust Belt in the old days. Those people, it was very enlightening. I learned a lot from them about how it's important to have the courage to change, how you have to be willing to disrupt or you're going to be disrupted. And these are like lessons that I learned. And I thought, yeah, this is right for every one of these cities has to, and these people have to have the courage to change and have to be willing to change and willing to be disrupted. They're going to not be, you know, earning a living in the future. So it's a big transition culturally as well, because we don't have a Silicon Valley type culture in some of these places that were hit hard by the job loss. So people like John Chambers can come in from Silicon Valley and help to instill more of a Silicon Valley type culture. And I think that that's working.
Yes. And I want my listeners to know you were on this particular journey focusing on Michigan, Indiana, and four states in central Appalachia, Kentucky, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and West Virginia. Flint, Michigan, where, boy, they were in the news just not all that long ago, and it was really a very tragic news story. And it was about politicians, about, you know, contaminated water and all kinds of things, you know, came out. It really was something. And Flint, Michigan, and I found the information that you give in your book, Silicon Heartland, Transforming the Midwest to Rust Belt, or from Rust Belt to Tech Belt. In going through it, you give information about how things were and how things are and what's evolving. And the rapidness of this evolution, I think, is very intense, but it engages education and so many other modalities. But in the 70s, General Motors employed 80,000 people in a surrounding county. There was a population of 190,000, and that went down to 81,000, and more than a third in Flint, Michigan, live in poverty. And this is one of the highest rates for poverty levels in the nation. And there's so many other things going on there as well. It is coming back to life. When you were in Flint, Michigan, how were you able to set up these conversations with people? Because it's absolutely amazing, the conversations and the attitudes of the people that are investing in an area that many would say, why bother? It's, you know, it's derelict housing. It's terrible. Why are you bothering this place? It's a dump. Don't bother with that. How did you get these interviews set up? This is amazing to me.
Well, look, again, this is a hometown champion who is leading the way, Phil Hagerman, who is from Flint and made his wealth in the area and is now giving back. And I visited Phil and interviewed him at the incubator, startup incubator that he had set up in downtown Flint. And he also was buying real estate and redeveloping it, like the old GM building, the old GM headquarters in downtown Flint. That one, and the building right next door to it, which was an old department store. He fixed that up. So several buildings in downtown Buffalo he did. In Flint, he renovated. He made one of them into a co-working space and a startup incubator so that startup founders had a place to go and to mingle and to be with one another and to give one another inspiration and to help one another. So people like that are a driving force and are absolutely necessary. So I think Flint today would have been totally stagnant without somebody like him being willing to step up and take charge, basically, along with the politicians. And the city is coming back. But it's an amazing, you know, it's quite the journey because, you know, the Buick City complex is totally gone, where Flint was the place where Buicks were built. Well, that's gone. It's all torn down. So now replacement industries are going in that are much more tech-oriented. And so I interviewed some of the entrepreneurs who are behind some of these startups.
Dayton, Ohio. Now, Ohio is, that's home for you. There's just absolutely so much that you know. And, of course, there's the association of Orville and Wilbur Wright. You know, the fellows that we all know about did that daring plane ride that lasted for, what, a minute? And yet it was the beginning of an industry that just was amazing, just amazing to see where we are today because they took a risk. They dared to step outside the box. It's just incredible. But you visited the Wright Brothers Cycle Company that you said dates back to the 1890s.
Yeah.
And I don't think anybody knows about that. I don't think anybody has any idea how resourceful these two men were.
Right. You know, and Dayton has always had an innovative thread about it. It was considered like a Silicon Valley before Silicon Valley existed. There were a lot of inventors in Dayton. And there was a lot of what was around mechanical kind of things, auto making, flying, flight, and so that tradition continues today. And it's really interesting that you also have the Air Force Research Lab in Dayton, and you have the Air Force Museum. So you have a lot of flight-oriented technology going on in Dayton, which I think is a real plus, because if you're a startup in that city, you can get plugged into selling your kind of, and I met several entrepreneurs who were doing this, who created battle fighting or battle gear, and they were selling to the military, to the Air Force, or some sort of flight equipment to the military, because you have a built-in contractor right there in your home base. And so the Entrepreneur Center in Dayton is very much helping to pave the way between the military and the entrepreneurs in Dayton to make that connection and to help some of these local startups get going and to help diversify the economy You have to have a diversified economy. You can't depend on one industry. Dayton was National Cash Register, NCR. Well, when NCR moved, that was a major blow for the city.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't depend on one industry. You've got to have diversification. So that's where startups can be a huge help in economic development.
There is a man, Scott Corndyke, that you mention in your book, who's the executive director of the Entrepreneur Center, and it is the leading technology business incubator. You know, this is so important. There isn't anyone or any level of industry that's all about one person. It takes a lot of people to create, I'll say for business, the infrastructure that's going to be able to withstand shifts and changes. You have, and you mentioned the word diversity. Diversity is absolutely necessary. And to be able to have something like this in Dayton, this really brings a lot of new concepts into the very environment that is going to be good maybe for a period of time. But look at how fast changes have evolved just in the last 20 years with technology. Now, it took a lot of time to be able to get them to this momentum, but that's not going to be it. We're not going to stop there. We can't. We have to keep moving forward. And sometimes that's very difficult for people to accept. Tell us about Scott Corndyke and also the gentleman who speaks so highly of him, Mr. Riplinghaus.
Oh, he's the one I just was referring to, Battlesite Technology, where he's developed these devices that help soldiers see in the night and also detect hazards. And so he started this business in Dayton after coming back, after serving in the military. He came back to his hometown, Dayton, started up this company, got the help from Scott Corndyke and the Entrepreneur Center, and has been able to sell to the military. He's got a thriving business going in just a couple of years. But I think that this happened because of the community support.
Mm-hmm.
And I cannot emphasize that enough, of how you have to have being an entrepreneur is a lonely journey. You can't do it alone. You've got to have a lot of support. And so community support is the priority here. And no one will succeed without that. And I think that's where smaller towns like Dayton, which is not a huge city, it's not like 500,000 people, it lends itself more to a community kind of environment where people know one another, they can help one another, they can join into groups, and entrepreneurs help one another. So I think I saw that happen in several of the cities that I visited.
With the other conversation that you had while you were in Dayton, it was with tech entrepreneur Max Yoder, and you say you have a copy of his book that's titled Do Better Work that you really value because it's about clarity, camaraderie, and progress. Your interaction with him, what was that like?
Yes, this is in Indianapolis. Max Yoder started a business called Lessonly, and he actually has managed to sell that business now. So he's one of the success stories of the Heartland, and we need a lot more of those kind of success stories to create this flywheel effect of more and more successes. But meeting him, I just realized that he's a very creative individual. I met him in the midst of COVID at his office. We were the only ones at his office, both wearing masks. He gave me the tour of the place, which included a grand piano. Back then it was a lot of gadgets that you have in these startup environments to entertain people, like pool tables and pianos and racquetball. So everywhere we stopped, he got engaged. Like, he sat down at the piano and started playing. He's a classically trained pianist as well as an entrepreneur. So he's very creative, very smart. He led the team, and he raised a sufficient amount of funding from Indianapolis, and was able to sell the business at quite a nice chunk of change. So he is an inspiration, a hero, a local hero in that area, in Indianapolis. His business was not all that, you know, I wouldn't say it was revolutionary, but it was the right business for the right time as software as a service was taking off, and he developed a kind of training development in the cloud kind of program. So that hit a lot of corporations at the right time, and he sold a lot of contracts. So, yeah, but he... he's from Indianapolis, and it's a real localized story. He's from Indianapolis. He got the funding from Indianapolis. He set up in Indianapolis. He sold the business, actually, to an out-of-state company, but it's a true and true Indianapolis story.
Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. You met a man, Eddie Beale, a geologist. I hope I pronounced his last name correctly. But you talk about so much information regarding Pittsburgh. Between 1970 and 1990, the region lost 158,000 manufacturing jobs, and 289,000 people left because there was no work. So 30% of the population moved out of Pittsburgh. Well, now there is all of this development, and it is considered, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, is considered the leading national hub for artificial intelligence and robotics. And what amazed me was this was also relating to agricultural factors, and they produce, with this one company, 500,000 pounds of leafy greens that were grown in their very first year, and they're wanting to take this into a nearby community so that they can have food. But this is growing food a whole different way. This is something that's so vitally necessary. I saw a display of something like this up in Anchorage, Alaska, in their museum, because in the state of Alaska, and if anybody has known any old-timers, you had to have your food flown in, the growing time of anything up there in Alaska. You were lucky, might be 3 months. But here we go. Here I see the vertical farming being explored and developed in a state that's almost like a world unto itself. That's Anchorage, Alaska, or Alaska as a state again. You have this also going on in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Well, yeah, I really like this company, this startup, and vertical farming is one of these areas that is growing really fast. And what was most fascinating about meeting Austin Webb at his startup in Pittsburgh is that it was in the most impoverished part of Pittsburgh, called Braddock. And his business was planted right next to the last steel mill in Pittsburgh, the very last standing steel mill in Pittsburgh, where it's still working. And the steel workers are still going in, and the steam is coming out of the factory. And right next to that is this vertical farming company using artificial intelligence to grow the vegetables and to grow them hydroponically without water. So it's just an amazing story. A lot of credit goes to him for trying this in a place like Pittsburgh, in a very rusty place, which needs more of these kinds of tech startups to continue its ascent from the old rust heritage, you know, steel town. I remember I interviewed the mayor in Pittsburgh, and I noticed this myself, but I'd like to quote him as saying, we're making progress, but we still have our scars that show, you know, our scars of the past still show. And I thought, well, that is definitely true, because there are parts of Pittsburgh that you don't want to look at too much, but then there are these other parts that are very advanced, particularly around Carnegie Mellon University which is producing a lot of these new engineers in AI and robotics, so that Pittsburgh has become a major player in the whole self-driving mobility revolution, because that's all very dependent upon AI and sensors. So these engineers that are trained by Carnegie Mellon are top of the top. And that's why Google is in Pittsburgh, you know, Amazon is in Pittsburgh. A lot of these tech companies have set up in Pittsburgh to tap into that talent. So Pittsburgh is a happening place. The population is starting to come back. It's kind of stabilized, where it had lost a large percentage of its population, like many of the other Rust Belt cities lost a large percentage of their population. So Pittsburgh is one of these comeback cities.
About two-thirds of the 278 U.S. auto plant dinosaurs, and I'm quoting directly from your book, have been repurposed and retrofitted in recent decades by electric vehicle makers. Where? Tesla, he took over a closed GM Toyota plant in Fremont, California. GM rebranded an all-electric factory, Zero, in Detroit. Rivian paid a whole bunch of money to purchase a shut Chrysler Mitsubishi plant in Normal, Illinois, which is close to Chicago. And GM's Willow Run plant in Detroit is now being utilized as an American Center for Mobility for Self-Driving Researching and Testing. And then Detroit Manufacturing Systems, which is a supplier for automobiles, they installed nearly 400 new positions for workers at a new plant in Toledo to make a new Jeep Wrangler. And the stories that you have in here go on. And primarily, what you call the tech tools in the Rust Belt, they are repurposing abandoned plants and sites, which I've just covered a few, leveraging corporate resources, raising money in various ways, really investing in research and development, integrating digital technologies, licensing patented technology, rehiring laid-off workers, yeah, and working with universities, with graduates, looking at how people can be retrained and creating new businesses out of this. This is something, the logistics are absolutely exciting. And you also bring in the fact that there is a big increase in the Black community as far as entrepreneurship goes, and in working towards establishing that understanding. It doesn't make any difference who you are. It doesn't make any difference what your gender is or your ethnicity. Go to work. This is a different environment in today's world. I think that's exciting, Rebecca.
Yeah, it's just a very positive story of a rebound. It's happening right now. Maybe it's not top of mind on the coast, like in New York or Boston or Los Angeles. But if you go into the grassroots, do a grassroots exploration like I did and see it up close, up firsthand, you'll see that these factories are being redeveloped. All these old warehouses are being turned into something else. Downtowns are being revitalized. Real estate developers are buying up, getting good bargains in some of these downtown areas. And that is part of the whole transition, too, because it's about lifestyle as well. You have to have a place where it's attractive to live, where there's lots of things to do, lots of good restaurants, sports, you know, and nice housing. So this is underway, too, and it's part of the broader picture of redevelopment. So it's not just tech, but it's also a lifestyle factor as well. And I think what we saw during COVID was the advent of remote working, and that people could work anywhere. And so many of them did start working in places they may not have considered before, that they had to go into an office before. Now they don't, so they can go to work in Pittsburgh or Detroit or Cincinnati and have a good salary there and have a lower cost of living, but still have a new, a nice lifestyle environment too. So the whole remote working has fed into this transformation of the heartland.
Also, you went into West Virginia, and I can remember as a child, my father driving through the mountains of West Virginia, and the poverty was just heartbreaking that you saw.
Yeah.
And there was little opportunity. Well, transportation alone was a big challenge. And how are you going to get an education? That was a big challenge, too, for a lot of the people.
Right.
That has changed. And you bring out the fact that there is the Rockefeller Neuroscience Institute.
Yeah.
That is there, and you met a very, very well-known surgeon, Ali Rezai. Tell us what happened with that interview, because this is incredible information that you're sharing with people.
Well, while I was in West Virginia, I was introduced to the head of this Rockefeller Neurological Institute, and I was invited to go and see the facility and to interview him. He's world-class scientist, technologist, and in West Virginia, in Appalachia, who is working on areas where we can help to cure Alzheimer's and other brain-oriented diseases. So it's a very leading-edge institute funded by the Rockefellers in the Appalachian Mountains of West Virginia, and it is it's just one of these remarkable finds that I made in my Rust Belt travels. When I started out on this, I did have an itinerary of places I wanted to go to, people I wanted to interview, but along the way things would happen where, oh, well, you have to see this, and you've got to go there. And that's how this Rockefeller visit happened at the Neurological Institute in West Virginia. It was unplanned, but it happened spontaneously, and it was one of the best interviews that I had. I was totally blown away by him, and he's working on things that can revolutionize human health.
Isn't it amazing how blinded we are in general by a lack of real information about real people and the real shifts? Part of the American spirit that has always been very deep in its ancestry is the desire to be able to move forward, the desire to have the freedom to be engaged in something that makes you feel good about what you're doing, and that education is available, and that you can make a difference, and you can go after, quote unquote, whatever your dream might be, that it may not come out exactly as you think it should. Sometimes it has to change because maybe the vision isn't big enough. So here we are with this information that you provide in Silicon Heartland. And when I was reading it, I thought, how significant this is and how disassociated we have become as Americans with our own country. And we hear all kinds of little blips, about 30 seconds, maybe to a minute. If you're lucky, you might get 3 minutes of information. And so often, so much of it is about how things are failing. Instead of looking at all of these people and these different environments that are the guts of what makes this country amazing. In the Second World War, before it even became activated, Franklin Delano Roosevelt ended up putting together industrialists throughout the country. And we were able to do things that no one believed we were capable of doing. And to me, this is so similar to that. And there's so much that goes more behind the story. But it is the innovators the creative people that can convert whatever it is that they're doing into something that's even more important than they could have ever imagined, and become a part of a complete infrastructure that adds to the richness of the culture in America of freedom, independent thinking, and being able to develop, stand strong, and keep adapting. This is something that when I was reading your book, it meant so much to me, because no matter what a person's age is, no matter what their educational level is, no matter where they are, they need to know that there are people out there, not just one or two, but there are millions of people out there that are each doing the best that they can with where they are. But when they come together and they have that diversification of thinking and a willingness to be in that entrepreneurial set, it can make changes that are breathtakingly amazing. We would look at them as miracles because of the way it evolves. But really, it is that human capacity for adaptation and shifting. And this is something that you give out as far as West Virginia goes, and how West Virginia, the people there, the individuals that are the innovators, those that are the leaders that are willing to listen to new ideas, this is something they're stepping up to. There is so much that's out there in propaganda relative to parts of the country that you are just saying, excuse me, you better wipe your slate of thinking clear, because this is not 1940 we're talking about. We're talking about 2023 and where we're going from here.
Right. So, you know, this region has been called the flyover zone, ignored by the coastal cities. But now that's changing, as we've seen more of a U.S. industrial policy toward building back better and putting more money into these regional hubs that were overlooked before, that have a lot to offer, strong universities, strong corporations, a lot of talent, a lot of grit, a lot of determination, many universities. All driving forward. And so now we've seen a lot more governmental money coming into these regions. And we have a U.S. industrial policy to rebuild and to compete with China. And I think that this is a very positive sign for our nation.
I very much concur with that. One of the statements that you make in your book, and this was made, I believe, by a gentleman by the name of Ratner, but this is Kara Dingus Brooke. I think she was the one that quoted this. She said, it's not so much about the money, but about the mindset, a culture of diminished expectations. Now, this is something that when I read that, and I highlighted it in the book, a culture of diminished expectations, stepping outside of that is so very important. And when I read that, I thought that needs to be put up on the board for every educational institution that there is. We don't throw the baby out with the bathwater when it comes to the past. You take those gold nuggets that will serve us, period, and that you move forward. You do the adaptation. And I thought that quote was extraordinarily significant.
Well, right. I do think that this confidence factor and being willing to go out and try something new without fear of failure is an important ingredient. And that kind of culture is starting to change in the Midwest, in the heartland. It's very abundant in places like Silicon Valley, where every day somebody's starting up something new. But in the heartland, it's rarer still. It's not Silicon Valley yet. It may not ever be Silicon Valley, and I hope it doesn't become just another Silicon Valley, which I don't think it will ever be because it's so different. It's so much more diversified than Silicon Valley with its very tech focus. But this confidence factor, and I agree with you about that quote. That was very meaningful. A culture of diminished expectations. And I thought, yes, and that's what I escaped. When I left, right after college and went to New York City and went directly into a career in journalism. I was escaping that, and, you know, it took me, you know, that confidence has grown over the years. But I see it when I go back to my hometown regions. I'll hear people say, well, I guess. And I think, why do you say I guess? Don't say that. You have to be firmer in your beliefs.
Mm-hmm. And that goes across the board. And that's why when we hear commentaries from whatever aspect it comes from, whether it is someone in your local neighborhood or it is on the news media, when you hear points of information that take away the understanding that the individual, and when those individuals recognize and have the confidence they should have, and they are able to work together as a team, when you collaborate together with an objective that is really solid, and you have to have a discussion about this, you have to work with that. And when you do that, then you're going to have a result that is going to be utterly earth-shaking. And this is what we have seen in the space program when it was done during Kennedy's administration, and there's so many other examples that can be given. People came together and they said, we will be a part of something that is going to make a difference, that we can be proud of, and we can make it better than anyone else. That worked, and that mentality was so strong during World War II, and we've got the same evolution that is happening today. So right. Young people need to be supported in the understanding you're not in a dead-end world, not at all. And I want to share with my audience, and this is in your book, Silicon Heartland, Tech Hubs and Innovation Specialties, Youngstown, 3D Printing, Detroit, Advanced Manufacturing, Dayton, Cybersecurity, Cincinnati, Packaged Goods evolving from Procter & Gamble and all kinds of things happening there, Columbus, Ohio, InsurTech and health tech startups, Indianapolis, software as a service, Cleveland, biotech, Pittsburgh, robotics and artificial intelligence. And there's so much more. We don't have time in our hour together to really go into all of the detail that you provide, but it makes for a fascinating read because you're talking, Rebecca, about real people. There is not a business that exists that doesn't depend on people. And when we can recognize that and we can understand the value and importance of education, of questioning, of exploring, just like you did when you left home, when things seemed to not be anywhere close to where you wanted to be, look at how your life has evolved. And yet now when you go back to that environment, you find that in Ohio, there's rock and rolling going on in ways that you never imagined. When you finished this trip, what was that like for you? What do you think is going to be on your agenda relative to what you learned about this revitalization of the manufacturing industrial environment in America?
Well, right. Yeah, it's not universal. I have to say that this innovation that's happening is happening in clusters, and you just mentioned these various cities that I wrote about and highlighted for their various specializations. So I think this idea of specialization is something that's going to continue to grow stronger, and that we will have these regional innovation hubs that Silicon Valley is very much software, tech-focused, but there's at least 7 or 8 different tech clusters throughout the heartland that are strong in different areas that are all developing very rapidly. So covering all of these and seeing them develop and mature, I think, is an important thing, and I hope to contribute to the content that is out there about what's happening and its importance, and how this is a future driver of America's growth. that it cannot just be one industry. It has to be these diversified industries that are in the heartland. And the heartland can be a rebalancing, can it be a something that retips the balance of power more inland from the coast. So following this story, it's going to be very challenging because it's not just one market. It's at least eight. And they're all remote from one another, at least 5 hours driving distance from the next place. So covering them, and actually there really never has been a regional coverage of what's happening. My Silicon Heartland book was the first that kind of highlighted what was going on. So I want to continue to cover that and cover it well and highlight the trends as they take place.
Well, I think you are going to have a very, very interesting adventure. And before we will be saying goodbye, I wanted to give some information that's in your book, and it relates to China. And you say, and I'm going to quote from your book, "China's swift catch-up in technology and R&D underscores the urgency for the United States to tackle the challenges of rebuilding the Rust Belt and revitalizing its research and manufacturing base. China now files 25% of global patents, while America's share has declined to 21.5%. And China's money that it's putting into research and development is just amazing. And there is so much that is occurring. And in a way, I think it's good you're bringing this information out, because part of the American spirit is, okay, you can do this, let's see if I can do it better. And that is what needs to be implemented. That is what we need to teach our young people. And we need to educate many of the adults who have this attitude of, well, there's nothing much. They get comfortable. And every time you get too comfortable, you get lazy. And right. I think that is what has happened. We have right. become so acclimated that people want a perfect world where everything's going to be perfectly insulated and we're never going to have any problems. And we just know it all. I beg to differ. You study human history, and that is not the facts of the human experience. And being cozy and comfortable, I'm not against it. I like all the blessings and benefits that have come into my life. And that's including doing what we're doing with this conversation. It wouldn't have been possible 10 years ago to the degree it is today. So here we are, but yet we've still got to grow. And if you look at nature, nature does not like a void. And all you have to do is sometimes walk into rundown areas and you find weeds and flowers growing in places you never could have imagined that were possible. And by golly, that is exactly what we need to remember, that there's always space and room to grow. And if we're not willing to do that, somebody else will. And I think that what you have done is just so incredible. If you were to be in front of a group of young people in a college that their eyes are bright, they're looking, you know, they're so caught up with their smartphones and other things, what would you want them to know just from this first journey? And I know you're going to be taking other ones, but what from this journey, what would you want those college students to know?
Well, that the U.S. Is in a turnaround mode from the loss of its industry, of its basic industry, and now that this is rebuilding in new ways that new talent can tap into, if they tap into it in the right way. And they need to do this in order to move ahead. And so I think we are seeing China competing much more aggressively. And so we need to continue to be aware of that. So it's very challenging time.
Challenging times, but yet exciting times. And I think that's what's important, is to be aware of these different individuals that are saying, we can hear stuff on the news, we can do this, we can do that, we can do the other, but hey, let's roll up our shirt sleeves. We can make a difference. Let's get busy. I don't have time to be engaged in that which is not working. Let's take a look at what we can do to see how we can make things shift and change, and then go about the business of doing it. They're not just flapping their gums, they're walking the walk. And this is what impressed me very strongly about what you discovered about the Silicon Heartland and transforming the Midwest from Rust Belt to Tech Belt. We've got to get our heads out of the sands of ignorance, because it is people that will make the change. And just like we're concerned about climate environments and the changing of this, that, and the other, we have to realize there's some things we cannot control. But what we can control is what we choose to be a part of. And be aware that there are options to read, to be able to have conversations with people. I think of quote-unquote town meetings and how conversation, innovation can be introduced in meetings like that without fear. And this is something that I like to think is evolving that has been lost along the way. Rebecca Fannin, you have had so much experience in so many different modalities, and your books are an amazing read. But this one was very, very meaningful to me because it really emphasizes that one should never, ever give up on the American spirit, because the American spirit is diversified. We have cultures from all over the world that are in our nation, and brilliance doesn't reside in one particular group of any type, any shape, any color, any belief system. We all can contribute in a positive way and get excited about the process, whether we get recognition or not. Silicon Heartland, Transforming the Midwest from Rust Belt to Tech Belt, is a powerhouse book. And people talk about peace, but peace can only be attained when we're willing to invest in making sure that we communicate and that we do invest in what we know we need to do for the changes and the adaptations that need to be made. Rebecca, your website, where do people go to find out more about your work?
Oh, sure. My website is SilicondragonVentures.com. I'll repeat it, SilicondragonVentures.com. It's actually based upon my first book, Silicon Dragon, with ventures added onto it. So it has all of my events and books and newsletters and videos, interviews with venture capitalists, entrepreneurs, innovators, a whole host of content on that website. And, of course, the book is available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. All of my books are, all four. But the most recent one, Silicon Heartland, just published very recently this year. And so definitely go out to Amazon. And once you do the Amazon buy, you can do a review on Amazon, which can help to get your own name out there. Some people do that. Just to review the book and get their own name associated with the book. So that's just a little tip there for any listeners out there.
Thank you, Rebecca Fannin, for being my guest. Before I say goodbye, I want to give you a quote. The challenge of the mid-century is defined for our own children and through international cooperation for the children of the world, the means by which they can be helped to develop their fullest powers for creative living. Only in this way can we help to build the kind of world in which an enduring peace, with freedom and justice for all, how it will be achieved.
This is Donna Sebo. Thank you for joining me and my guests for this dynamic and informational hour. Tell your friends and family about the program. We look forward to having you join us again. Have a magnificent and free life.